Hey, everybody. Thank you for coming to this seminar, which is How Craft Spirit Trends Are Driving Investments. I'm Colin Spoolman. I am a distiller and founder of Kings County Distillery in Brooklyn, and I'm also a board member at ACSA and very privileged to have a significant role in this organization, which is very exciting to see everybody here for the annual convention. I will just briefly introduce the panelists, but they'll give themselves or they'll give a broader introduction. But we have Emmett Strack from Park Street on the far side. We have Kevin O'Brien, who is a partner at Zeponian Company. Ryan Lake from Arlington Capital Advisors, and Jason Barrett from the esteemed Black Label Distillery. So I will give it over to Emmett for the presentation.
All right. Hello, everyone. Good to see so many faces in this room today. Like you said, I'm Emmett Strack. I'm going to be your moderator today. I am from Park Street University, where I'm a content lead. And basically at Park Street University, our goal is to give as many free educational resources and tools to industry members as possible. And I don't think it's too much to say that joining me up here, we've got some experts in this field who have walked this road many times before. And they're going to help us better understand the landscape of M&A in 2024 and how we as industry members can learn from it. Because at the end of the day, even if you're not looking to sell your business, getting a better understanding of broader industry dynamics is really important to kind of shaping your strategy. So I'm going to kind of have these guys introduce themselves and how they each, their experience relates to the topic a little bit. So we'll start with Kevin here.
All right. Morning, everyone. I was just telling Ryan, I've got an 11-year-old daughter on Friday. And anytime I go to conferences, she still to this day says, why would anyone want to hear you speak? So this is the confidence I'm coming in with. So Kevin O'Brien, I'm a partner at Zeponian Company. Headquarters is in Santa Rosa, California. I run our Pacific Northwest office out of Portland, Oregon. We focus primarily in wine and spirits. We have deals with Constellation, Gallo, Biotech, Southside, kind of larger alcohol firms across the spectrum. We mostly work on the sell side. And it's been really interesting, and Ryan, I'll get into it in a little bit about how that buyer pool has overlapped over the last couple of years in particular. I'm a board member for Cascade Spirits, which is a brand house out of the Pacific Northwest. A lot of it's vodka, that's kind of a lead horse there. So that's been pretty interesting to kind of learn the insights team there. So looking forward to having a robust conversation today.
Hi, Ryan Lake, Colony Capital Advisors. Routine advisory firm, kind of like I'm starting to work with beverage companies, right? So all sorts of consumer products and services. And we've done transactions for basically every beverage segment here. So spirits, RTDs, beer, a little bit of wine, not much. I don't know if you play wine, I was like, I'm this. But suppliers, distributors, retailers, importers. So basically every segment, every tier, we've covered in some way, shape, or form. And it's kind of this point, the more things are converging, the more these conversations become relevant across different categories and tiers. And it might put me on some things. All I do is drink alcohol all the time. Too. So, what are the words that can tell you?
That sounds fair.
Yeah. And then my name is Jason Barrett. I'm the founder and master distiller at Black Wine Distillery. 12 years ago, I founded the Wine Distillery and a great year of green bourbon green gin. We successfully completed a minority acquisition from Constellation Brand, and actually a few months ago that exit of that acquisition. So I have walked the road and come back and happy to be here. So looking forward to talking to all of you guys about how that happened.
All right, perfect. Thanks, guys. So before we dive in here, I'm just going to set the stage a little bit because this is definitely a pretty curious time for M&A. And we'll talk about 2023, but just to give you guys some background, according to Park Street's 2021 M&A report, 3 years ago, this sector more or less exploded with lots of high-profile acquisitions from strategics, and four of them that crossed the $1 billion mark. And in 2022, M&A kind of kept a pace in a year where beverage alcohol was, on the whole, it was reducing for the rest of M&A sectors. So I'm just kind of curious to hear from you guys, beyond COVID, why did this sector kind of blossom from 2020 to 2022, and how much did craft spirits have to do with that?
Not all of us. Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot of change post-COVID. I think that you had a product that was in bottles, cans, venture packs that was in retail off-premise. Obviously, we did pretty well, but the on-premise shut down, but that drove a lot of investments.
a lot of that initial on your brain launches. Actually, buyers are looking for growth or looking for category gaps, making investments or acquisitions in that time frame. And so there's a lot of trends that came out of COVID related to the changing retail landscape that was, you know, fairly temporary in some markets.
Right. And I think you had a situation too, having the COVID era, you got folks, especially in the spirits industry, you can't cut back on bartenders. And so what that really drove was you couldn't go out to a restaurant or a bar. A lot of people were experimenting at home and realizing that the markup on a cocktail is pretty significant. And so they were able to buy kind of higher end, more premium liquor. And so that really drove kind of that higher end that kept pushing the price. And so I think, you know, for a lot of the larger suppliers, if they didn't have a brand that was kind of in that price category, it became pretty attractive for them. On top of that, you still had a really low interest rate environment. You had consumers that were flush with cash. You had businesses that their balance sheets were very large and doing great. And so I think the combination of those, we were never busier than 21, 22. Ryan and I were going before. It was challenging to keep our employees because they were just so taxed because there were so many deals going on. So I think a combination of those factors.
Yeah, I mean, also anytime that there are disruptions, those disruptions create opportunities, whether for entrepreneurs to capitalize on and ultimately for strategics looking to catch that next wave. You know, and they're always starting to catch things on the upswing. So, you know, had on-premise stayed shut down much longer, you know, many of these things would have worked out. I also think there was a little bit of a blip. You know, some of these deals do take a long time to come to fruition. And so I think that's why we stayed steady in some of those.
Yeah. And then in 2023, we saw a clear shift, right? Some of the trends that were brought on from COVID began to moderate. We saw high interest rates and inflation that really meant that funding was really hard to come by. So just for you guys, how would you kind of characterize 2023 as a year for M&A? And, you know, why was it different from what we'd seen previously?
So 2023, you know, I gave a presentation a couple weeks ago, and I kind of boiled it down for three factors. You mentioned too, the straight environment. You know, you're in a period of about 12 to 15 years of low interest rate environment. So cost of capital is really cheap and really affordable. That changed dramatically. And I'm sure a lot of folks in the room dealt with that. They want credit. You know, you're interested in slab 3-4 flat times to what they were prior 5, 10, 15 years. That has an impact. Inflation, right? As a consumer, I buy a lot of the groceries in our house and I spent $8 for eggs. And I said, what is this? You know, so it was like death by a thousand cuts in the consumer perspective. I think people were pulling back what they call discretionary spending. And the other factor is that I put up a slide that basically it was December 2022, Bloomberg saying 100% chance of recession 2023. 100% across the board. Do you fast forward now, and there was a slide I put up that was basically a year later saying our economic in the U.S. were outperforming all of the G7 countries because of all these factors with GDP growth, real wage growth, inflation's coming down. So it was just a kind of a perfect storm from a finance perspective. And so for folks like ourselves, a lot of people were pausing and just saying, like, well, we got to figure out internally what's going on because as you are all aware, right, you have an oligopoly system in the wine and spirits distribution. You have two big houses you can play with. They were going through some internal stuff. If your sales are slowing down as a larger supplier, you're not going to get the board's approval to make an acquisition unless it's really critical and really necessary. So there was a lot of acquisitions in 21, 22. Part of it, too, is digesting those and making sure you fully integrate those. And then also, there was just a lot of skepticism in the market in general.
Yeah, I would agree with all that. I'm just saying, I think there's a lot of development in 23 and it really started mid-22 when inflation started to creep up. And one thing that's not held up by our stores that are making acquisitions is funding development. You know, like things are not all whole. They're going up into the left. They can predict the future using that acquisition from the world's rate home. Inflation go up, interest rates go up, geopolitical stuff. It's really all it requires to get the board behind something and you can't feel confident that what's going to happen. And nothing better has happened to that. It's all affected what's happening in food, what's happening in the broader political environments, other consumer products, some high-consumer products, all tied together. And all those things go back to our large.
I think also as we look at the fact that, you know, there have been some turning on some of these initial craft spirit acquisitions or other craft beverage acquisitions, some of them aren't going that well.
But they guys are struggling to integrate these entrepreneurial operations, and they aren't growing as fast as they are. And I think that gives a lot of pause. You know, if it's your first or second acquisition, kind of playing that way, you have to take a major write down, or your board's not going to be as interested in kicking off the next one. I also have, you know, from talking to several of the strategics, have really heard that the case volume when they want to do those acquisitions is rising. And I think if you go back 4 or 5 years, there was a thought that maybe a 30 or 40,000 case brand could be integrated successfully on a nationwide platform. And now it's really starting to sound like that number is above 100,000 cases per year. And it'd be much more discerning in terms of number of SKUs, number of states that the person's already in, that alignment again, the two big houses for distribution. And I guess they're learning from the challenges of the early acquisitions, and that's making it a more cautious environment. And then the interest rates.
Yeah, one thing that is never underestimated from a factor who deals, and you think this is a company is being very disciplined, strategic, and on these boards, and they do, but almost every deal, there's one person in firm that has influence to drive the deal and champions it. And if that person changes jobs or deciding they want to do that deal, means the deal all starts. So I hate to say that, usually it's one person that drives the deal.
100%. 1,000%.
Yeah. And I mean, so you guys are kind of alluding to like a change in deal structure that's going on. And a lot of the activity that we saw kind of going on with multinational strategics over the last couple of years has shifted a little bit. We're not seeing so many outright takeovers anymore. It's more smaller scale and bolt-on acquisitions. Is this kind of tracking with what you guys are seeing in the market right now?
Yeah, definitely. You know, to Jason's point, if you look at 5, 6 years ago, when there was a lot of activity for folks like yourself, crash year three, right? If you look at these accelerators, the Diageo, Sopranos, the Constellation that had defined units, it was kind of a venture capital spring prey model. So they'd make 10 bets, one or two stick, great. The other ones, they could take the loss. That model hasn't proven very successful. And they'll acknowledge it too, because, you know, a lot of brands are successful that were looking to kind of get to the next level had that classic decision. Do we build internally and pay for the sales force, which is really expensive, or do we partner somebody that already has kind of the large scale sales and distribution channel ready for us? And so when that didn't really play out, or maybe they made some promises, the reality was, if you're a small brand, you're not going to get the attention from the sales team, like the bonus structure based on Booming, Jameson, or whatever else, these large volume brands. And so it left a lot of the entrepreneurs feeling like, not bait and switch, but like, hey, wait a minute, I thought this was going to be integrated a little bit better. The result of that, what's important for you, is that those avenues are kind of closed. And what that means is that there's maybe less buyers out there or less competition. And when there's lower competition, it tends to drive valuations down, right? Whenever we run a process, we're trying to get as many folks involved as possible so we can have them bid against each other. If there's less buyers in there, there's less amount of competition. They also know what their peers are doing. And so that's kind of driven where you see, and we'll get the multiples down. We see the valuation expectations. They're not being absorbed by the smaller brands yet, but the strategics are certainly saying it's a different world for your services.
Yeah, I guess I would add to that. I mean, I think for the buyer case, some buyers are still looking at smaller things they can find in that fit well with existing brand portfolio gaps. And then the different side of the world is looking at simplifying portfolio. This is happening across Spirit, Sphere, and now a lot of leagues are trying to simplify what they have. They feel like they've unbought too much pre-COVID to go with a host over, and they're trying to simplify it. Big brands, they can move in a way they might move brands. You've seen it with Coke shutting down you've seen it with your company investing in brands. A lot of the experience companies are divesting or trying to divest brands that aren't core anymore. And so there's sort of bifurcation between, do you still go for small tuck-in, highly creative things, or do you try to certain ways, fake things that you can move relatively efficient performance?
Yeah, and we have a member on our panel here who has had a lot of experience with divestment. Jason, could you just tell us a little bit about maybe what made your brand so attractive to Constellation in those early days when they were vetting you? And then we'll get into the divestment part after.
Yeah, so I want to echo the statement from earlier. You can never underestimate how critical the human connection ends up being. Most people are probably aware that Constellation Brands is also headquartered in Rochester, New York. and that had to have been a factor in our success. We had a long-standing relationship with Constellation on the technical side, helping us with some implementation issues and other things, again, probably due to being co-located. Black Button makes 45 products. One of them is 75% of our sales. That item specifically competed, and the Rochester area out-competed, a competing product for a different strategic, more than national strategic. Constellation was very clear that that was all they were interested in. And in fact, you know, it probably would have made sense to shut down the rest of those brand 45 items and just focus on the one. You know, we had, you know, we took 2 years to do the due diligence and finally get the investment. Within 3 weeks, the Adventures was promoted. There's going to be the Adventures for the new annual plan. That person got promoted. There was going to be the Adventures for the new annual plan. And then the next year, there was a new VP Adventures with a new annual plan. And those plans started to shift. They no longer really included us. We also just, you know, had some challenges in timing. We were, for all of 2019, put together a 14-state nationwide launch, hired people, built up inventory, and went live with RNBC on March 1st, 2020. No. Yeah. But it was a really good plan. We felt we were all very confident in it. So we reset it for March 1st, 2021. And that day probably doesn't ring quite in as many people's ears, but that was the day the Constellation announced they were leaving RNDC for Southern. But we launched in RNDC on the exact day that Constellation lost RNDC $1 million. Frosty. If I can describe some of those distributor meetings. All the other time was like, no, I actually found out in a room about this size, with everyone in the audience being very distant. So that was awkward. I luckily got a Texas a lot. you know, at that point, we had a good relationship with the guys at Constellation. I still think highly of many of the people that we worked with there. I learned many things, and luckily we were able to come to a mutual agreement that our path and their path were no longer aligned. And at that point, how do we move forward? We were fortunate enough to be able to come to a resolution where we were able to purchase back their shares. I don't know that could have things having gone right, we would have been in that position. Ultimately we came together to execute a plan, we're unable to execute that plan, and partnered our strengths to focus on the things that each of us are good at. They'll continue to grow consumer brands, we'll continue to grow our products in New York State, and then ultimately the business division that they just had no interest in. It wasn't a line. It wasn't that it was a bad business. It's just not the business they're in. They're in the business of brands. As we turned to more of a B2B play, we just weren't a fit for the portfolio.
I want to kind of get into talking about how we as craft brands can kind of position ourselves in this current M&A environment. And I think a lot of, a big question at least for new founders is whether to strive for growth or profitability. I think investors historically have leaned high growth. And now in the current market, we're seeing an inclination towards positive cash flow. That's kind of what investors want to see these days. So I'm curious from you guys, how brands should kind of balance profitability and high growth at the same time. Like, how would you kind of stride between these two metrics?
Well, so by way of background, I'm a CPA by trade, a retired CPA. I decided that I like investment banking more fun. I like going forward versus backwards, but I'll put that hat on with them off if I need to. It's what I really tell folks is that without margin, there's no mission, meaning your mission is to make the greatest XYZ spirit. If you're not watching the margin there, it becomes really challenging to cover all the other low gross margin. So I think there's a balance, right, where you're focusing on running a sustainable business for yourself, right? Just being the families, all that type of stuff, but also understanding that growth does help, right? So growth is something that you most folks want to see happen, but it's not growth at all costs. So we get phone calls all the time, and this is both wine and spirits.
that, hey, started a couple of years ago, I've got this great portfolio, I'm in 45 states. Wow. How many cases? 5,000 cases. It's not good. So, and I tell you that because unfortunately there's kind of that mindset that when you get a call, somebody likes your products. You want to say yes, right? So if you're based in California and somebody in New Hampshire calls you, now you've opened New Hampshire. It's great. You're going to get more sales. Well, in this environment now, boots on the ground, right? Distributors, they're just moving boxes. They're not really selling products for you, as you all probably know, painfully. And so not having the ability to find sales folks that are really going to be pounding the ground, as it were, in those markets is actually really challenging. And so it's not growth at all costs. I mean, one of the things we tell folks, and this is even before the current environment, is deep, not wide, right? If we talk about KPIs and turns, there's one strategic, pretty large. Every time I talk to them, hey, how's it going? Got this client, you know, I'm talking to, what's the velocity? What's the velocity? What's the velocity? Okay. So really, their focus is like, what's the pull off the shelf? Right. So it's great if you can open up a bunch of states, but then does the product just sit and be dusty on there and not actually run itself through? Versus, you know, we have for Cascade Spirits, right? One of the things we're talking about before is the I-5 strategy. Own I-5, California, Oregon, Washington. You can travel there within a day for the most part. And you can own that area. Allow the big folks to move you out east, west, and whatever it is, because they're going to have resources that you're just not going to have. That's one of the biggest mistakes I'd see. So the balance of growth, but at what cost? And so growing into multiple different markets is not going to be helpful.
I totally agree. We usually take a look at like, don't build a business to sell it. That's a super dangerous thing to do from your perspective. Build a sustainable business first. And if the consumer reacts to it well, you will eventually find a business that maybe you can't sell at some point. But yeah, it starts qualitatively brain position. Understand what your brain is. Why you make what you make, why you sell it where you sell it, is in the right accounts, in the right markets, not pre-tapped. It's not pulling, figure out why, or even the wrong market, is the wrong price line, it's something else. Because once you figure out the brand positioning, consumer response to it well, the velocity will fall. And the truth is, there's that one guy that always asks that question, but every buyer and every sophisticated investor will get to what is your loss. if your product is not pulling off the shelf or off the back bar, at a good enough velocity to make sure that retailer keeps it on there, you're going to lose that account eventually. And that's going to be incredibly damaging. And if you've got, you know, 100,000 placements and 10,000 are pulling at an adequate velocity, you should not be at 90,000 placements. Pull back to the ones that aren't pulling. Let it build itself organically. You've got other retailers drawing you in, so it's pulling all of them because velocity is a killer.
Yeah, I mean, fundamentally, I have a very skewed version view of this sometimes. My venture is on a buying company since 1922. Profits at the end of the year are strict. And that would be continuing me, figuratively, from a very young age. So, I mean, to me, when businesses are deficit funding, it doesn't mean you don't ever deficit fund it to grow, but that is an incredibly dangerous thing. And I think as an industry, we have potentially, implied that, you know, if you love your spirit enough, and if it's unique enough, you're going to be the next Casamigos $1 billion. Is George Clooney either? No. Okay. And has anyone else here started in major motion pictures? No. Okay. And I'm not saying there aren't other routes to marketing, certainly. But fundamentally, most of us are not going to be acquired by a top five streamer. That's just the statistics. And therefore, having a safe business, one that can stand on its own 2 feet, that can turn a profit, even a very, very small one, is now all of a sudden something that is much more likely to go on and continue on, especially during disruptions like we're seeing today. You know, for folks that are raising millions of dollars every 18 to 24 months, that are finding huge sales forces that aren't driving enough of that velocity, you are, you know, those brand plays incredibly risky, incredibly high rewarding if they work out. But I liken it to doing the monkey bar as well, why fold it over lava, and you don't know where the bars are. And I can't be that from a physical perspective. So my other question to this is, where can you develop a niche that is unique to you? So at this point, we only sell in New York State. New York Farm Distillery, people in New York seem to care about New York Farms. So it's a little harder to convince people in Texas and Colorado that New York Farm Distillery makes sense. I've got good friends in Virginia. And I gotta be honest, I do not understand the Virginia ABC at all. And they do. And that is their business that they crush at. And to some degree, it is better that I crush in New York and they crush in Virginia and folks that actually deal with, you know, like we don't have chains in New York. So dealing with a Specs or a Bibby's or an ABC is not something we can't figure out. Well, it's just not how our plays are built. Our plays are built for a one owner store and we heavily index into that in New York. So I highly recommend that folks first and foremost try to have a sustainable business because that also then opens up the opportunity of who the acquirer could be. If the acquirer isn't going to be a top five strategic, it's likely to be a more disciplined financial investor. That generally means they want to pay a multiple of EBITDA. We were approached by a brand that actually asked us to acquire them. Very nice people. They've been longtime friends. They earned a profit last year of $17. And I give them a lot of credit. There's a lot of people that weren't in black at all. But how do I, there is no multiple of earnings that I could give them that would be respectful against the work they have done. And it doesn't matter what price earning ratio we use. And so therefore we declined to make them an offer. That's not any money. So that was well, it was really nice to be asked. And luckily it looks like he's on path for a different someone from outside the industry but in the local community to acquire that. And at the end of the day, these are small businesses. How do we build sustainable small businesses that are great at what they do, that have longevity, that are great places for our employees to work, have a return on investment to our investors, and aren't just counting on being on that moonshot. Because if the only path forward is this incredibly large boom, what happens to the 99% of people that don't execute that? And it is incredibly challenging, and I think getting more challenging, as we've already discussed, not only are the top five starting to realize that they're not, that they haven't been as positive the ones that executed, but also that white space is starting to fill up. Just, you know, does Diageo really need another kind of sea with step? I think they got one, I heard of. Do they, you know, does any of these guys need, you know, does Constellation need an MGP-based bourbon brand that sources all their spirits? I think they've got one or two of those. So where now, as those guys are successful, will you find other parties that are starting to play in this? Yeah, the same more recently being acquired by East Serrano, who hasn't historically done a lot of M&A. Sure. But the space is getting a lot more crowded than it was 20 years ago. And that doesn't mean there aren't still opportunities, but it does mean that all of us, yeah, you have to decide what is the risk reward profile willing to put on the field.
Kevin and Jason, you guys were kind of talking about KPIs a little bit. And I know a conversation we've had on the side is that a lot of times brands approach M&A conversations really before they're ready. So turning to you guys, what do you think some specific KPIs are that you want to see brands have in place before they kind of approach those conversations?
100,000 cases. We were in a unique position where during our divestment, we were talking to many of other folks, and I'm not saying they aren't acquiring anyone with under 100,000 cases, but Constellation, Diageo, Pernod, your 10,000 cases a year doesn't actually help them. And I think 30 to 50 was more of the range a few years ago, but again, with all things you already talked about, everything I was hearing as we were talking to these folks, and I think we need better access than most because of our business, the business supply side. We just have to carry a number of 100,000 cases. And again, for most of us in that room, that's actually a pretty daunting number. Because from the Bacchia project, we know that very few craft spirits are, yeah, in that realm.
I think it's more situational than that. There are categories that look small, 9,000, small, 50. It really is situational. And I'd say this, keep in mind what a buyer for strategic is looking for is usually growth. And so they look for certain metrics. You buy a huge room, like your past room, that's your future growth, is what they're trying to acquire. So they're looking at what metrics today tell them your brand will grow in the future. And so it's things like velocity, it's things like geographic white space. You're 5,000 cases in 45 states, how do you have a lot of white space left? You're probably not going to deep in all those markets, but more to kind of go buy in 3 years where they could go up and launch your brand in that market and do a better job than you can because they have more leverage that will sell. So it's future growth that they're trying to buy, and it's a mix of pricing, it's a mix of velocity, geographic white space. If other portfolio things you could add to, there are also white space in terms of portfolio fit. So they're trying to figure out how they grow your brand in the future, how they capitalize on that, and they look at metrics today and try to give an indication of that stuff.
Yeah, one thing I want to add, like Jason alluded to it earlier, white space, so just for everybody's benefit. So in our office, we'll look at all the larger wine and spirits suppliers, and we'll chart it out, right? Here are the price points, and here are the beverage categories. Where do they not have a product? And so when somebody approaches us, we're like, okay, well, we're going to call the agile administration, call X, Y, Z company. And so once they fill that white space, they've already kind of on the bingo board, right? Checked it off. And so they're not really incentivized to go out and do that again, right? Because they've listened to their distributor partner, she's the retailers, and now they have a product there. And so that's what white space really is, just from a perspective. And that's like a single, that's like a whiskey at $50 or tequila at $30. One thing that I always try to talk about in presentations is, you know, we're talking case numbers. So whether it's 100,000, whether it's 60,000, whether it's 25,000, the numbers go up and down. That doesn't mean your whole portfolio. So because of that white space and the fact that it is, and they pulled out that single, what we call that V-horse SKU, and that's if they want to plug in. That's what they want to focus on. They don't want self-fluid SKUs. They don't have time, resources. It's just not part, right? Distributors want to hear a simple story. So we get a lot of phone calls saying, I've got a great rum, a great vodka, great gin, teeth, tequila. It's just, what's driving sales? Well, they're all I need. That's just not going to be attractive for a strategic. To Jason's point, run a good business and you can find somebody, but that's not the same strategic model. You've seen Ken Austin doing over and over like his brands he's launched. If you look at the DNA, it's very specific. High-end tequila, right? It is a Irish whiskey, but that's it. And they just put all the resources behind that. That's built to sell, like literally built to sell. But most of craft distilleries, that's not the playbook. And nor should it be the playbook. So I think it's important too to realize that this is just in the U.S., there's always in consumers for craft, right? And Ryan knows very well what happened with craft beer, right? You know, there was a boom there in 2015, 2016, and some of these brands started to go national. And then it just became a barrier to entry to start a brewery, became lower and lower and lower, more entrance got in. And so it became a hyper-local product. Now, that industry is going through some challenges, but there are ones that have successful businesses. And they're not trying to get acquired. They're not trying to get out of shape. They're just saying, let's have a great be a great employer, a great product, and like this will pay our bills. There's definitely nothing wrong with that. And I think that there's been so much ink spilled on the M&A space, and Grant, we're working in this, but I love small businesses. And so I just want to encourage folks that like where you think you may find yourself down the road could be difficult. And so really focus on what you do and what you do well.
Kind of turning to the current market a little bit, what are some of the beverage alcohol categories that are gaining traction right now and are really motivating investors, and maybe some ones that are going to continue to do this down the road beyond 2024?
I'd say RTEs are on time to hide ever since COVID. RTEs existed for a long time before and all RTEs got kind of that word in the last few years. It's a great category. I would say acquirers are having a really hard time figuring out which brand will be the winners in that space. That's making it really hard for them to make good investments or acquisitions. So sometimes you see something like category itself, very healthy, growing dynamic, and maybe too dynamic. Or acquire now, like things sort of settle out and there's sort of a punishment hurt. But again, I think in general, RTD is a good category. There's several subcategories of spirits. There's still a lot. Everyone still likes whiskey. So I feel it in the already saturated sort of price points. I still like Cognac and the Cognac side of issues. Those brands, gin, a lot of good, you know, good next 10, 15 years, but there's going to be some ups and downs within that. But I would say spirits and the macro category is the place to be. And then there's subcategories than spirits that are better places to be than others. But certainly, you don't want to be in craft beer right now. It's a very tough place to be. Why is that some challenges? But spirits is a great category to be in. So you're only like space. It's just 10 times you want to play that. Geographies
and I don't know if you folks saw the DISCUS report that came out last month. They do a really wonderful job of their report and just the data and whatnot. But if you look at like share of servings, you know, for I think 30 years, but beer has been this. Spirits now overtook beer and wine. It's just kind of been just flatlining, starting to drop back a little bit. The largest categories, spirits overtook beer, and then wine's down below pretty far. And why I say that is that the buyer pool has increased. So I just want to caveat what we said before, right? That's in these larger five strategics that are kind of backing off. We do a lot of work in the wine space, right? And so the distribution houses are pretty much the same, right? You have Southern and you have the RNDC. So it's not that different. The Pierre is kind of a different situation there, but they have kind of shared distribution relationships and they're seeing spirits up, wine kind of petering out, staying steady, I suppose. Let's get into that market. So you're seeing acquisitions, Foley Family Wines, right? Guy owns Fidelity, a lot of money. You know, it's the Vegas Golden Knights. It's bought Bentley Heritage out in Nevada. Beautiful facility. They're looking for a lot more spirits brands. We're having some conversations with that. Yattle, obviously, you know, they're the new one spirits brand now. High Noon. Everyone's doing great. So they keep being acquisitive. And the wine group wants to get more in there. Jackson Family Wines wants to get more in there. Constellation's already diversified enough, but there's these wine companies that we're really close with that are saying, are we missing the boat here? There's a lot of synergies that we can do. So my hope is, and we look towards 2024 and beyond, is that you'll have a diversification of the buyer pool that are just looking at how do we get share of, I think Coca-Cola says that a Budweiser, share of fresh.
Is it Budweiser or Coca-Cola?
We'll go. Budweiser company, Molson Coors, they made an acquisition this year, their first spirits acquisition. They had launched a whiskey brand before. Coca-Cola just bought 1090 of vodka. Heineken bought a huge distillery out of South Africa. These are traditionally singly focused in beer or wine. Now there's just this blurring of the lines as folks are trying to catch up with consumers who are no longer just having two glasses of wine at dinner or just having two cocktails or having a couple pints. They're having a cocktail and a glass of wine and maybe a pint afterwards. And so they're trying to be proactive in meeting consumers where they are. So I think that's a really important part to understand is that this blurring of the lines, I don't see that stopping anytime soon.
No, it's a good point. I mean, we're seeing the beer companies do the same thing. Yeah, Molson Coors, La Boulange, Sailor Bottom Riding Ridge, and RTDs, spirits-based RTDs, specifically are bringing beer companies into traditional spirits because their distributors are picking those up. And so they let them in that space too, and that's going to draw them into traditional bottled spirits. And you've seen Anheuser Busch bought Colorado. And now Reyes, who is the biggest finished beer in the country by mile, they are now a very lower staff ratio in several of their markets. That I was at the USWA 2 or 3 weeks ago and had three Reyes mothers and seven of their team walking around that show. It was the thing I've never said 5 years ago. And then you have the biggest beer distributor in the country. He was a $25 billion ranking company. He was now making huge moves in spirits distribution. So yeah, it's all coming together and the convergence of the retailer, distributors, and consumer is going to draw beer suppliers, NIOF suppliers, wine suppliers into making spirits acquisitions in the years.
And then one other thing that I find somewhat interesting that I think may directly connect with folks in this room, I think we're starting to see some, like we saw in beer, some hyper-localization, some hyper-regionalization. So you're seeing, you know, folks out of the, you know, for Midwest that are starting to really focus on what is rye whiskey from there mean. What does New York Empire rye? Or who's going to end up owning that category? And same for California. What is the quintessential craft spirit of California? And as those folks are able to go super deep in those areas, it may not be an ancient wine play, but even putting together, you know, four or five really strong regional players, that ultimately end up making up a hell of a team. I think that's got some opportunities still to be done, and still to be seen.
All right, I think we're getting pretty close to time here, and I want to make sure we have a second to take questions from the audience if we have any, but can we just get a round of applause for these guys? SIJ.
Good afternoon. Well, you had mentioned the whiskey and vodka and tequila market. I think you've seen with the brandy market.
Yeah, I mean, I think brandy is interesting. It doesn't have quite the same cachet as cognac. I think long-term, I see an interesting path there. It's something that hasn't felt yet. It's like Robert was saying, I'm wrong to bring you on. I think it's going to happen eventually. Something's got to make that move. I just haven't seen it take a real, full consumer's mind yet, in my opinion.
Yeah, I mean, second that it's not there today, but to some degree, there is a question. The biggest payoffs are that contrarian thinking where you end up being a big mover before somebody else is. One of the first nationwide brands to be an MGP rye-based product, was buying rye back when people didn't want it and made that category what now is a very common business model. So that's certainly a question. I don't see brandy there today, but where will it be in 5 years? I think potentially some of the people in this room have the opportunity to influence that.
Yeah, I mean, especially the popcorn cube was 5 years ago, I want to say. I think that's going okay. I think they kind of shifted towards more gin. So, I think the original investment thesis is that they were finding ahead of it. Again, that's where I'm very, if we get ahead of this right now and it grows, it'll be great. Zoe Gallup's got the Jermaine Lebon, and so that's done okay as well. And so I think it's an interesting category. I think as you have more overlap with the wine space, there's a lot of folks that have access and try to figure out what to do with it. And so they put their muscle behind it, it'd be a really interesting category.
Got another question right here.
Yeah, so you talk a lot about being bought by the big guys. What about in the smaller plays where is there a market where they kind of recognize good smaller performance and investing and get to that point?
Well, I mean, you're starting to see, and if you folks know Zigbottom, a lot of sleep beverages, he's raised to fund to help find like grants grow. So he's building portfolio to do that. There's some other smaller venture arms that are out there. I mean, Ryan could probably talk to this with a little bit more education about kind of what's going on in craft space, where there's now this craft on craft, whether it's a merger or acquisition, 1 + 1 = 3. I could see an opportunity for that down the road where they have complementary products and you can write along to the distributors and kind of offer them more products. And, Case is saying, regionally, what that sense of place is, I could see that kind of evolving over time.
Yeah, I think this is taking time for that next tier of buyers to emerge. The need for it is clearly a big guy that aren't going to buy a lot. They're very selective. They know what's happening. They're more so now. I think you see what's happening with beer, buying out. There is this emerging mid-tier players. And maybe NGP is a border that right now is still pretty large. They're a little bit smaller. I think you see the emerging tiers within that. Now you've got people like Chris or Cattle into Lawrencetown, Giant Family Office, not going to make one move, which. So you see players like that, and now they have a platform. They can go both on smaller things to that. We've seen some of the corollaries too in beer. We sold New Belgium Brewing to Lion Pure. Lion was looking to make a big U.S. move in beer for years. Nothing really made sense. But they bought New Belgium, suddenly had a national platform for them. So it was marketing team, and distribution, they got production. Now they can bolt on smaller things. I think you'll see the same trend in spirits over time, where some either financial player with standing out with an international strategic and no U.S. presence, say, hey, can I buy a large or mid-sized player in the U.S. and then I can do smaller acquisitions? But I think it'll take some time for those players to emerge.
I think we have another question right here. Go for it.
Can you guys share a little bit of your experience behind valuation methodology and maybe also the mindset between the buy side and the sell side?
Question. You want to take it first?
The question was about valuation methodologies. So, and then also kind of the bid-ask spread. It's that's kind of one of the things. So, a lot about valuation. There's no syllable in that. Historically, for spirits, a lot of it's been focused on top line revenue. And so, you see these acquisitions because, spirits category has a lot of advertising, sales, and marketing that goes. And so, a lot of brands are growing, right? They're finding losses to grow that. I also agree, Simon, I'm sure you do that. So revenue is the multiple there. contribution margin is another way that it's for brands. So we sold Vivint Tucker and Masterson's a couple of years ago to Deutsche, and that was a carve out of a portfolio, a brain house. And so on that, it wasn't necessarily revenue, it was contribution margin. It's essentially revenue less cost of goods, gross margin less how your direct advertising and marketing costs. And there was a multiple on that. EBITDA is not really something that gets played around with in the spirit space. Wine all the time. EBITDA is what drives things. But spirits, it's not. And that's what's the big disconnect with these wine brands. But wine companies are coming in being like, you know, I'll pay 12 times EBITDA for this. But a lot of spirits companies don't have a really strong EBITDA. So we're having to push them up the P&L, as it were. And so there's a little bit of a disconnect from the wine buying pool, kind of how it works in the spirit space. What I'll say, though, is what was is not what is. What I mean by that is that we referenced it earlier, with the interest rate environment being what it is, a lot of it can stabilize, even though maybe it got down the road here. But going back to where we were last 12, 15 years, it's probably not going to happen for a while. So cost of capital being so cheap, if you're plugging in your investment thesis, you know, your discount rate's way lower, so your return on investment, so you can pay more for it because the cost of capital is less. Now the cost of capital is higher to be able to pay less. And then we talk to folks and they're saying, well, I mean, this guy got 5 times revenue or whatever it is 3 years ago. And it's like, respectfully, 3 years ago is a way different economic environment. And so there is, and we're seeing that cross categories. So M&A was slowish, not just in where we were, but just in general. There's a lot of entrepreneurs that point back to a deal that was done in 2021 or 2022. If I actually wait a minute, like, I have my investment horizons, my needs. These don't connect anymore. I cannot pay you what I would have paid you 3 years ago. I'm sorry. And so you're in a situation where we've not seen the interest rate go that quick and that fast. And so what are the ramifications of that? Is that people's investment thesis has changed, and that pushes down valuation expectations.
Yeah, I agree with all that. I said valuation is always a tricky question because we are in the eye of every single investor. They're going to run their own model, their synergies, the lack thereof, their return requirements. And sometimes it triangulates to a multiple of revenue or a contribution margin or EBITDA to have it. I mean, I think Green River and RSI effectively trade on EBITDA and they have a lot, and they're also contract businesses, so it hard to do a brand value. But the truth is, it's going to be subjective. And I think we're seeing a lot recently in the last 2 or 3 years, a little pre-COVID too, but especially post-COVID, is that a way to bridge that gap, if there is a big one, between the buyer and seller is to get creative and structure. A lot of the buyers now maybe got burned on paying too much up front with no real risk on the seller. And so they're saying, hey, we're willing to pay you a big price if things work out in the future. So maybe there's less guaranteed cash up front. There's more of a performance based, or it's deferred, or it's something an earn out for seller notes. And so then, look, if you want to take some more risk on it, we're willing to give you more back it if the brand performs as you say one. And if it doesn't, we have to take all the risks as a buyer. So there's creative ways to bridge that gap. Take both parties alone and do it.
And then the only other thing I'll add is that technically any deal at the right price is what will the buyer and will it seller can come here. And I do echo the idea that looking back at some of the deals from a few years ago, it's just not relevant anymore.
Awesome, guys. We're going to call it there. We're at time. But thank you all so much to everyone for coming out today.